with kids sitting on my lap. Thank God. I wasn't sure I could really handle that end of the Santa package. Then, I had to. Fast forward several years. Once again, I found myself putting on the fake fat for a holiday special I hosted for the History Channel called Surviving the Holidays with Lewis Black. I was to play an actual Santa at a New York store. Now there were real kids. Wide-eyed, sad-eyed, cross-eyed, snot-ridden, full of wonder, full of fear, full of life. Real live kids. Sitting there in Santa's chair, all dressed up like old Saint Nick himself, you look down to the eyes of these kids who are staring at you as if you really are who you're pretending to be. You start to realize that there's something eerie about the whole experience. Being awash in all of that innocence, that hope, especially when you're the one who has never bought into any of this happy claptrap. It was a real test of my acting ability, and I didn't think I was up to it. After all, I'm not Mr. Warm and Fuzzy. I find it exhausting. And you can't fool kids. It's bizarre at best to be a middle-aged Jew dressed up as Santa Claus, whose job it is to ask a kid what he wants for Christmas, knowing full well you can't deliver the goods. I pretty much felt like the head of FEMA during the Katrina crisis. So here I was, potentially setting these youngsters up for a bitter disappointment. As their little feet scuttle down the stairs on Christmas morn, only to find that the kitten, the favorite doll of the year's greatest new toy, or the miniature pony that they asked for and you said would be delivered, isn't there. You created expectations that wouldn't be fulfilled and were never going to be by the likes of you. You might as well have taken a shit under the tree for all the goodwill you created. You destroyed their Christmas. Or maybe you should look at it in a more positive light. Maybe, you conclude, you've prepared those children for what truly lies ahead for them. Disappointment and despair. Learning that at an early age will leave them better prepared for real life than that happy kid who got the new virtual reality hoo-ha that everyone wants but is so tough to find. But he got it. That hardly ever happens. Stores run out of it. Just like doctors will someday when they hand out, say, the cancer vaccine. By the time they get to you, sorry, we ran out. Bastards. After playing Santa twice, I can't figure out who enjoys being Santa. In the end, you're just a big, fat, compulsive liar. You're no savior. You're just leading a child to his first disappointment. The first of many. Soon, the child's eyes are opened, and he's screaming at his parents. Santa's not real. Are you shitting me? Who ate the cookies and milk all those years? You, Dad? Why, you son of a bitch! Though I've never experienced this happy moment of revelation, even I know it's got to be tougher than losing one's virginity. This is the moment when the trust and the faith that you had in your parents, your guardians and protectors, can't be relied on anymore. What else have they been lying to me about? Are they even my parents? Maybe I'll fall asleep one night and wake up the next morning in a ditch by the side of the road. There'll be a note from them that says, "Don't worry, Santa will come pick you up in a minute, unless you were sleeping when he arrived to get you." Santa doesn't like that. He'll just be on his merry way. So, goodbye. Good luck. Oh, by the way, we aren't real either. Guess I won't be sleeping anymore. So, on the set, I sat there and ho-ho-hoed as I lifted each one of those kids onto my knee. They looked into my eyes with a mixture of bewilderment, joy, and a deep-seated mistrust. Some of them just seemed to be in panic mode, and some of them knew it was all bullshit. Yet, they were ready to expound on all of their wishes, from the most materialistic to wanting there to be world peace. I sat through all of it, gasping for air through a beard that I swear was made from recycled fiberglass. And the costume I wore had apparently been dipped in some sort of heavy-duty industrial sealant. It had all the breathability of a rubber suit. My pores were weeping as I stewed in my own juices, sweating like a porker. After a while, your brain can't stop screaming. It's fucking hot as hell! As you gaze down at the child in your lap and try to utter with some semblance of a smile on your face, and what would you like Santa to bring you for Christmas? Rimpf kabui snap pute. What did you say? I didn't hear you, my dear little angel. I didn't hear you because all I can hear are the screams from my overheated scalp. Or maybe they're coming from that area that lies between my brain and my skull. Maybe it's just because as much as I want to, I don't really give a shit. And the yelp de foodie kona sakala puche fume and titi. Oh, yes, I will get you the defooty and everything else you ask for, I reply, praying that I am close to understanding what the kid asked for. What's a defooty? I don't know. You asked for it, and you're going to get it. Sweat pours down my brow like water over Niagara Falls. I feel like I'm running a marathon while basting in my own perspiration. The whole thing isn't right. I am dying. Right now, dressed in a fat suit and fake beard, I'm dying. No one sweats like this and lives. Please get this kid off my lap before I'm forced to tear these clothes off so I don't die of heat stroke. Who the hell does this to themselves more than once? What sadistic world do we live in that allows such abuse to occur? A raging alcoholic is who? Someone who throws back 6 tumblers of Chablis before going to work and brings with him a flask filled with creme de menthe just to get through the day. It's the only way you could possibly stand this. I drink, therefore I am Santa. I know you're not supposed to drink around kids, which is why I didn't. But to do this more than once demands more mind-altering substances than I have access to. After playing Santa, I now think that at the end of that wonderful old movie, Miracle on 34th Street, when Maureen O'Hara and John Payne realize that the nice old man played by Edmund Gwenn is actually Santa, they should do the human thing. Electrocute him. Christmas Day, 1:45 p.m. Here comes the old giftless Jew. Thank God my friends don't ask me to dress up as Santa. I'd have to kill them. Here we are, the driver informs me as we pull up. As I enter the home of Willie and Jenny, I encounter the first Christmas tradition. The disappointed gazes of Gus and Leo. Oh, it's you, Louis. I know what they are thinking. We believe in Santa. We know he doesn't exist. But we still believe in him. We just don't believe in you, Louis. No gift? Really? Again? Then they hightail it to the back rooms of the apartment, no doubt to hide their disgust at the stinginess of their dad's stupid, cheap friend. Wait a minute. Why am I letting them upset me and undermine my festive fuck demeanor? They didn't buy me anything, did they? They didn't make an effort either. Yes, I feel better now. The living room is filled with members of Willie's and Jenny's families. And, of course, a Christmas tree, which towers over me, even though I am taller than it. Figure that out, genius. They are hovering over the hors d'oeuvres. There is, however, always something a bit existential about the gathering. Existential. Now, there's a word you rarely use anymore, unless you're in college and are wandering the campus feeling ennui because you just read Camus' The Stranger and didn't understand it. In fact, ennui is another one of those rarely used words that only comes to mind when one thinks about existentialism. It really is a vicious cycle. It's not the folks themselves who make it feel strange in that existential way. A few faces may change from year to year, but the people Willie and Jenny invite are all folks I enjoy spending time with. Not an asshole in the bunch. And everybody knows that come the holidays, assholes make things unbearable, not existential. They're the human version of the turd in the punch bowl. And I think they all feel the same way about me. They are all warm and welcoming. Or else they're all just too polite to let on otherwise. I can't put my finger on it, but as I stand there, I think that maybe things used to be more Christmassy in the good old days. Back when women wore hoop skirts and people uttered words like poppycock. Not like today, where it's entirely possible that the men are wearing the hoop skirts. And the poppycock is some kind of internet porn sensation. Or the name of a gay snack food. Information traveled so slowly in those days that it must have been a world of continual discovery. It must have seemed like a miracle to even see people you know all gathered in one place. And if one could believe in Jesus, surely one could believe in Santa. It was a time when one wore so many clothes and had to make sure that the horse and carriage were taken care of when you went to Aunt Pity Pat's for Christmas dinner. The snow was snowier then because there were fewer chemicals in it. So by the time one finally got settled around the hearth and raised a glass in toast, one truly felt thankful to have gotten there at all. My stars, Jeremiah! The womenfolk were certain the trip was too arduous and insisted you wouldn't make it for the festivities. But I said balderdash to that kind of talk. Balderdash, I say again, and Merry Christmas to one and all. Nowadays, Christmas seems to be a backdrop, in front of which we band of merry old souls gather. We are not so immersed in the holiday spirit as we would have been in times past. In fact, we're separated from it. We can point at it and comment on it, but not really wrap ourselves up in it the way our grandparents could. No, I am not stoned. Maybe the folks in the apartment a few floors above us are more immersed in holiday cheer. They could be using up all the Christmas in the building. Maybe they are so desperate to enjoy themselves, they took more than their fair share of the holiday. Maybe Christmas is like oxygen in a confined space, and there is only so much to go around. No, that's insane. Maybe I should be stoned. Well, for God's sakes, Mr. Black, of course there's an existential feel in the festive holiday air that we Christians share. For you, my friend, are a Jew. That's not the reason. I know it isn't. Maybe you have arrived on the scene after the joy of Noel had come and gone. No, they don't open their gifts until after we have our Christmas dinner. That's when I know it's time to leave. I don't need to sit through the icy stares of Gus and Leo and whatever other children are there whom I haven't gotten a gift for. Existential? How? In what way? Maybe next Christmas you should give Gus and Leo copies of Sartre and Camus, Uncle Stranger. It's about this time that I wonder if maybe I just have the flu. And then there are my good friends, Willie and Jenny, the ones who gather this tribe together. Jenny was raised in New York, too, and by a couple of geniuses, no less. Willie was raised by wolves. I'm kidding. It would be fun, though, to be raised by wolves, until the authorities came and grabbed you and shot your parents, of course. That would suck. Willie was actually raised in New Jersey, which is, contrary to popular belief, very nice. But I'd still rather be raised by wolves. I have known Willie for 30 years. He is the head writer of the New Electric Company and has spent years composing musicals with his brother Rob. He is also the founder of the 52nd Street Project, a mentoring program for the kids in that neighborhood. For that, he was given one of those MacArthur genius grants. Trust me, he is no genius. Ingenious. But not a genius. Willie is married to Jenny, who is a lovely woman with brain power to spare. Now, if she were the reason they said Will was a genius, I would concur. I would concur wholeheartedly. To be absolutely fair, however, that he was able to hide his myriad faults long enough to trick her into marriage just might be proof of his genius. Jenny was the assistant associate producer for 9 years at the Williamstown Theater Festival in Massachusetts and has since moved on to be a producer at the Public Theater in New York City. She was one of the main producers behind the hugely successful Broadway revival of Hair. And as I type, she has just been named the first woman to be the artistic director of the Williamstown Theater Festival. The reason I have given you my friends' resumes is to help you understand how extraordinary it is to me that two people in the same business, show business no less, could have not only very successful careers, but also a very successful marriage, and raise two lovely children. They not only have done this, but they are generous enough to expand their family circle to include somebody like me. As many people who do it, it's tough when both members of a couple are pursuing full-time careers. You have your shit, and they have their shit, and now you have all the shit that a marriage can bring to the table. It's a lot of shit. And if you have kids, then you've added their shit on top of your shit. You have to keep reminding yourself that the kid's shit is just as important as yours. And then you have to remind yourself that your shit is as important as theirs. I imagine it's like living in the emotional equivalent of an Escher drawing. And he's a Catholic, and she's a Jew. That can open a whole other can of worms, but it hasn't for them. Yet, in spite of all this, Willie and Jenny have a traditional marriage. I have enough trouble just dealing with myself and my career without being half insane most of the time. How the fuck do people do it? How the fuck do they make such a deep commitment to each other without going completely batshit? I stand in awe of them. Well, maybe not in awe. I'll save that for something truly beyond the realm of my belief system. But this is close to that. And every Christmas day I have spent with them, I envy the life they have fashioned together. And wonder, what the fuck is wrong with me? Christmas Day, 2 p.m. 6,500 calories. Not counting the 3 bottles of wine. I spend the first hour after my arrival catching up with everyone. Since I spend most of my life traveling from city to city performing, It's nice to hear about the accomplishments and the bullshit and the nonsense. It's soothing to know that life, real, normal human life, goes on. That over the last year, the kids have been doing well and have gone on to the next grade. And that school is good. That someone, not me, got a raise. That someone else, again, not me, has found a better job. It's nice to notice that the marriages seem to get stronger with the years. Maybe it's just a front they put up for the holidays, and deep down, they are all eating their insides out. That after the party, they go home and return to their lives of shared bitterness, oppressive claustrophobia, and boredom. They all go to bed that night thinking about how wonderful it must be to be me. Oh, if I were only Lewis, single, fancy free, devastatingly handsome, no one to answer to. He must be living a wonderful life. What a life, huh? Somehow, I doubt anybody thinks any of that. I can see that my friends are happy with their lives, their children, and what they are building together. It's always very comfortable as I sink into a very cushy chair and toast their accomplishments with a very nice glass of red wine. At this moment, as I sip my wine and am surrounded by friends, I always think of my brother Ron. He has long since left the planet, but I still miss him terribly, especially at times like this. He is the one who truly introduced me to the splendors of red wine when he was living in France. I visited him there. Yes, when I was broke and he had to pay for my plane ticket. And we spent some time in the vineyards and over numerous glasses of the grape. He was passionate about wine and food years before the concept hit our shores. He would have loved this moment when the glasses were being filled. He and Willie would have taken this time and turned it into a half-hour discussion about the friskiness of the grape. If wine weren't enough for male bonding, when Ronnie and Willie got together to cook, it was scary. They could carry on for days about how to really cook a lamb. Right, like the lamb cared. As they would debate all of the permutations of preparation, spices, and cooking time, they would twitch with glee. They were like crackheads getting ready for their next fix. Sometimes it really freaked me out. Okay, not sometimes, always. It always freaked me the fuck out. It upsets me that my brother never got to see America's changed attitude toward food. He was blogging about restaurants when he lived in France before there even was blogging. This was in the late 80s, when hardly anyone in America gave a shit about food. This was before supersizing your fast food meal was all the rage, and cardiologists from one end of this country to the other were building additions to their houses. For God's sake, he missed the arrival of the Food Network. Talk about life not being fair. Or maybe it is. Maybe he would have lost his mind watching it. So many kitchens, so many cuisines, and so little time. God damn it! This was his era, the golden age of food. I am always saddened when I think about all of the things we never had the chance to share. If there's a true downside to Christmas, it's remembering all of the folks who have passed on along the way. All that you have lost. Christmas may be about the birth of the baby Jesus, but it also makes you think a lot about the people you want to spend time with, but can't anymore. Yum. This wine sure is tasty. Remember, Lewis, you have to pace yourself. You're starting your Christmas celebrating at 2 p.m., and you won't be done until at least midnight. So don't go overboard too early. Take small sips, Lewis. Very small sips. I've never been good drinking during the day. This is a marathon, and there's no way to train for it. And if you did, you'd have to go to rehab by the time New Year's Eve rolled around. I also have to keep an eye on my food consumption. I am facing two huge meals that day, from a dazzling array of appetizers to a scrumptious series of desserts. And I love food. Not in a foodie way, in a love way. A deep, abiding adoration and worship kind of a way. I live and breathe to be immersed in a universe of tastes. I'm not an idiot. I know two massive meals in a day is wrong. It's bad for my health, bad for my stomach, bad for my large intestine, bad for my small intestine, bad for my colon, which I think is either my large or small intestine. I can't remember. It's bad all around. And it's greedy and piggish and self-indulgent. Let's face it. There's no excuse for this kind of behavior. People all over the world are starving. And on this day, I eat what a family of eight might consume in a week. But God help me, that doesn't stop me. I am like a locust on Christmas Day, and as I chew through everything that's set in front of me, from olives to exotic cheeses, to dried meats, to chips and dips, to clams casino, to the hindquarters or forequarters, or whatever quarters of the cow I find before me, one thought haunts me. Did I write a big enough check to America's harvest to make up for this gluttony? I never know. One of the great things about me in that category is a narrow one, is I don't need people around me to be judgmental about my behavior. Nobody is more judgmental about me than me. It's a gift. So I wonder, will God show me pictures of this day when he consigns me to the third rung of hell, where one is forced to view videos of buffets from around the world for an eternity and beyond? But if I don't come to Christmas dinners with my friends, what am I supposed to say to them? Well, no, I can't make it this year because I'm afraid I will face eternal damnation for eating one too many chèvres. Oh, you're only serving two. Never mind, I'll be there. As I ponder my sin while sipping my second glass of wine, Willie and Jenny are preparing another incomparable meal. How the fuck do these people do it? They have jobs, two children, friends, God knows what other concerns, and they cook great food. Where do they find the energy? How can they be so happy as they sweat over all of these ingredients? How do they know it's not going to taste like shit? I don't remember the last time I cooked. I used to cook a long time ago, when I had no money and no choice. I was a lousy cook. Big surprise, I know. But I cooked. Nothing very fancy. I mean, I could toss a salad, and no, not like in prison, for a guy named Sheetrock, but with fresh greens. And I did, for a time, bake my own bread. No one believes I did. Even the people who watched me do it think I am lying. But I did. Wheat bread, mostly. No baguettes or anything else that might require a little thought or energy. Just run-of-the-mill wheat bread. It was tasty, but it was never a full-blown loaf. I never got it to fully rise. Every loaf I made was always somewhere between matzah and Pepperidge Farm. Still, it was bread. You could cut it with a knife and put a pat of butter on it. It worked like the butter delivery system it was meant to be. It used to give me a great deal of satisfaction. What's happened to the world? When I made bread, I knew it was shit. But at least other bread was good for you. Now people say bread isn't good for you. When did the geniuses of the world decide that? Where do they hold that meeting? It's bread, for God's sake. It's the staff of life. Where are the Bible beaters now? How come they aren't defending bread's right to be eaten? Now, if you want to eat a sandwich, you need to jog, exercise, or ellipsoidalize, oh, spiteful bread, with all your stinking carbs. Where did you go wrong? What happened to the Harry the homemaker who used to dwell within me? Did all the carbs kill him? Willie and Jenny take such joy in preparing the meal. And for my part, I take great joy in eating it. Cooking, I just don't have the time for it anymore, but boy, do I have time to eat the whole day away. At the table, the conversation focuses on the food. The table begins to hum with the satisfaction that comes from a fine meal. The room is filled with the purring sounds of satisfied eaters. Really, it's not that difficult. All you do is take out the bone marrow and slowly cook in a port reduction and then let the short ribs marinate in that for a week. Where do you two get the fucking time to do this? I almost shout at them. But then I remember that there are tender ears at the table as well as my own. So I merely wonder to myself. All I know is I would have an easier time putting the short ribs back in the cow than I would preparing the dish that sits before me. Jenny's sister, Jillian, prepares the dessert. It is, as usual, stupefying. It's always a sensational sugar delivery system. I weep. Sometimes it even includes sugar spun into a work of art. I weep. She has an infant, and she's a master pastry chef with a full-time job. Isn't there an Olympics for people like her? People who can do all sorts of things really well and spin sugar at the same time? It makes a lot more sense than those folks who cross-country ski and then stop and use the rifle they're carrying to shoot at targets. What the fuck is that supposed to be about, other than some kind of sick World War II Scandinavian flashback? This time, we are having tiramisu, and there is a bonus dessert, which I have forgotten because of the obvious sugar shock I went through. But it was worth it. If I were told that I had to get diabetes for a major movie role, I would have Jillian prepare my dessert every night. After dinner and coffee and some more terrific conversation, it's time for me to go. I rise slowly from the table. One last time, I toast my hosts and all who have gathered together. I am overwhelmed by this sense of family that I am allowed to glimpse and share in. It has taken a bit of the sting out of the loneliness I always feel on this day. Yet, it makes me yearn for what I know I shall never have, a family of my own. Thank God there's another meal ahead to distract me from these thoughts. It's time to take my bloated frame downstairs and catch a cab from the Upper West Side of Manhattan to the Upper East Side. I move slowly. Very slowly. It's time for the next round of appetizers, and only one thought consumes me as I climb into the taxi heading for my next destination. If there really is a St. Nick, they will be serving pigs in a blanket. Granted, it's not an elegant offering, but they are delightfully simple and delish. Christmas Day, 5:30 p.m. If it's really over the river and through the woods, I'm not gonna make it. In the cab on the way to my friend Neil's apartment, once again, I am alone. As I sit in the back seat in silence, New York City is pretty quiet on Christmas afternoon as we drive through Central Park. I have some time to think. That's what I need. More time to think. And boy, do I think. I wonder why it is that the overwhelming drive that brings couples together to procreate somehow completely missed my gene pool. My brother and his wife never wanted to have children either. Salmon swim upstream to do it. Penguins go through hell to do it. Rams crack their skulls to do it. At what point along the way did my DNA say, ah, fuck it? It wasn't just my upbringing or a bad marriage. It has to be deep in the genetic blueprint of one's being, like wherever it is that diseases come from. Is it a mutation? Was there someone in my family tree who masturbated so much that the sperm forgot their purpose for being there in the first place? Was a meal served to one of my ancestors that was so intoxicating that it created a genetic obsession with food that replaced the drive in me that ensures the survival of the species? Did some woman chomp down hard on my great-great-great-grandfather's nuts? Whatever it was, it couldn't have been good. Maybe my brain believes that since I look pregnant and feel like I'm carrying a baby Louie down there, that I don't need to procreate. As I come to these unsettling and un-Christmassy conclusions, I need my stomach like dough in order to move baby Louie over to make room for more food. The Upper East Side of the city, where Neil lives, is a part of town that's a little more hoity and a bit toitier than the Upper West Side. Neil is neither. He is the kind of person who will surprise you. He doesn't even look like an Upper East Sider, which in my mind is a combination of Donald Trump and Joan Rivers. For one thing, his hair is long. Really, really long. It goes all the way down his back. He looks like he should be playing bass in a rock band. Not surprisingly, Neil has one foot firmly jammed in the heart of the 60s. On the Upper East Side, most people's feet are jammed in the heart of the 50s. The 1850s, when servants did everything but wipe your nose for you, and maybe even did that. It's the type of neighborhood where one feels entitled to feel entitled. Neil is the antithesis of that. He works way too hard to ever assume that kind of attitude. He doesn't tolerate that kind of attitude, yet he loves the neighborhood where the entitled flourish. He still says things like, you're either on the bus or off the bus. Neil says it with real authority, like he is absolutely certain of its import and its meaning. Sometimes when he says it, it scares people. More importantly, the reason he's not a real Upper East Sider, he was actually at Woodstock. He really was. Honest, I am not kidding. He even remembers some stuff that happened there. Sometimes I make him tell me about it, and then I forget that he told me, so it makes me feel like I was there. Sadly, there will come a time very soon when there will be a television interview with the last person alive who was actually at Woodstock. I really hope it's Neil. The two of us met at the Yale School of Trauma. I mean drama. He was in the technical program. I was never sure what these guys did there, but it was very technical. Neil now owns and runs Hudson Scenic Studio, the largest scene shop in New York. He has built the sets of an impressive number of shows, from off-off-Broadway to Broadway. The body of his work has garnered him a Tony Award. The son of a bitch knows what he's doing. While he was accomplishing all of these amazing feats of stagecraft, he also found the time, energy, and stamina to be married 3 times. Physicists haven't come up with a formula for that kind of energy. He really seems to like being married. He married young, and like many of those young marriages of our era, it ended 19 years later in divorce court. His second wife, Lori Beachman, was an extraordinary theatrical performer and exceptional singer. She died of ovarian cancer. They fell in love when she was in remission, and after they were married, the cancer returned. Love doesn't conquer all, but that's because life is brutally unfair. If it were me, I probably wouldn't have gotten married again. But while life may be unfair, it also has its beautiful moments. And so Neil met Machiko, who is now his wife. She worked for a company that did all of Michael Bloomberg's financials, taxes, and God knows what else. Yes, that Michael Bloomberg, New York City's billionaire mayor, who has more money than God. She was a financial analyst. I don't know what they do, but when they do it right, somebody makes a lot of money. And if they are wrong, somebody gets fucked. She is razor sharp and has a keen mind, and with all of that, even a lovely smile. How my friends managed to fool these beautiful, intelligent women into marrying them is a mystery for the ages. Machiko spends her time taking care of their daughter and works on a variety of fundraising projects and figures out where we are all going to go for Thanksgiving. They are very happy. She has made Neil slow down, which means he still uses more energy than any 3 people I know. The story of their marriage is unusual, which is putting it mildly. Before Neil and Machiko met, Neil had what can only be described as a one-night stand with a beautiful young woman, the result of which is she got pregnant. Please hold whatever recriminations you have to yourselves. In light of all the couples I have known over the years who've taken years to conceive and have turned to fertility specialists, here is my pal Neil, who falls into bed with a woman he barely knows, and in one shot, he does it. I can only call it astonishing. I'd love to know what the statistics are on pregnancies after a one-night stand. But this is a Christmas book, and we're veering into some unusual territory here. Let's move on. Then again, Christmas is all about a certain baby. Nah, better not. You can certainly ask, what were these 2 people thinking? But you could also ask, what was God thinking? Surely he knows better than that. It turns out, he does. And then, bingo, Neil's a dad. The woman wanted to be a mother. And even though Neil is Catholic and wasn't looking to get married or to live with the mother, he was thrilled about becoming a father. So he and the child's mother came to a legal arrangement. And several months later, a beautiful baby girl was born. Hang on to your hats and your sense of irony on Christmas Day. God damn you. Fuck you, Lewis. I realize that for the traditional family value folks, this is way too far-fetched a way to make a family. There are numerous Americans that hold on to the concept of the traditional marriage like a dog and their favorite bone. It makes them feel better to believe that a family unit is a mother and a father and their children, and that's that. And that's the way God planned it. For years, this concept kept alive millions of loveless marriages, and no doubt created sexual arrangements that ranged from the Neanderthal to the Gothic. In their wake, creating family environments that were nastily toxic, not only to the parents, but to their offspring as well. I don't know at what point the traditionalists will finally get it, but a family now comes in many, many forms, and as long as there is a loving environment, then one could be raised by wolves, gay wolves for Christ's sake. If I learned anything from having a child that wasn't mine, it's that every child is yours and should be treated as such, unless, of course, they happen to be a snotty little prick. Isn't that a better way to be traditional? I realize this is way too far-fetched an idea for the traditional family values folks. They also would be disturbed to find out that the universe is forever expanding. If they knew, they'd be devising ways to pour cement all over it. They believe in a God who likes things to stay the way they are, forever and ever. Amen. But I don't care. And neither should you, because if the birth of the baby Jesus teaches you anything, it's that there are lots of ways to make a family, even to have God as your fertility specialist. For Neil, this was the best way, and really the only way. People always say things happen for a reason, until they disagree with the reason it happened. I can't stand those kind of people. I've never been big on the whole concept of things happening for a reason. But the reason here was crystal clear. It was a beautiful baby girl, Sophie. If this weren't amazing enough, a few years later, Neil and Machiko fell in love, and she found the whole arrangement completely acceptable, with a few adjustments, I would imagine. They got married, and everybody is living happily ever after. Sometimes you've just got to tip your hat to the life force. This is definitely not the way they do things on the Upper East Side. What about the baby girl? She's growing up quite nicely with her two mothers and a father, thank you very much. Sophie is doing well in school. She doesn't need therapy or the myriad chemicals being administered to our children so they will sit still and learn. And she actually likes Jimi Hendrix and the Grateful Dead. Need I say more? From my vantage point, she is adjusted to what can only be described as an unusual family arrangement brilliantly. Maybe children are just a whole lot more fluid than adults realize. She certainly is more together than I am. My day goes up in flames when my coffee maker doesn't work, or when my editor says he doesn't like this sentence. Editor's note. Lewis, I never criticized this sentence. It's the paragraph I had problems with. It has never taken much to throw me off my game. Life can be fucking strange and odd, and who knows, maybe you're better off if you learn that lesson when you're young. It might be the vaccination that helps immunize you from the bumpy twists and turns that life brings your way. It may be a little easier to deal with the weird stuff that life can hit you with if you've already had a chunk of it thrown at you. Everyone involved in this story has been completely upfront about it, which I find stunning. In a world where people hide their mistresses, sexual proclivities, and whatever else they can fit in their psychic closets, the normal, traditional way of creating a family seems to have freaked me out, so I can't even begin to imagine what I would have done in Neil's shoes. I certainly would have been unable to have leaped into the type of family that Neil has embraced. If I were in Neil's situation, I would have responded by looking for work on the space shuttle. In the end, though, is this family arrangement any more strange than the chemistry set that many have to pay for in order to reproduce? I'm talking about the utter gymnastics required to get the borrowed sperm, the purchased eggs, the surrogate mothers, and all the pharmaceuticals in order to create a petri dish popover that will grow up to be the apple of someone's eye. Not to me, at least not this family. Once again, though, it just goes to show that most people want to procreate more than I do and will do anything to achieve it. I really don't get it. And on Christmas Day, I wonder, have I missed the point of life on this earth? You're here, announces my Ugandan cab driver. I have found that Ugandans always have the answer. It's downright amazing. Christmas Day, 6 p.m. Out eating the Christians, or is a 10,000-calorie dinner too much? You'd think that after all I've said about this girl, that I would arrive at Neil and Machiko's apartment with a wonderful gift for her. Nope. No birthday gift, no Christmas gift. I am in some form of gifting double jeopardy. I promise you, I am really not a total prick. What I am is at a complete loss when it comes to knowing what a little girl might like for Christmas or her birthday. Talk about pressure. I don't have a clue what I want for my birthday, let alone my friend's daughter. They live in a completely different world from what I was brought up in and what I now live in. When I was a boy, girls played with dolls and Kenner Easy Bake Ovens. You could really bake with them. You can still buy them, believe it or not. I don't know how the genius toy designers came up with this idea, as it is a lethal gift for kids. Shouldn't they be against the law? Not only because of the electricity that soars through it and the heating coil, but for dietary reasons. Toys shouldn't make kids fat. She's 10 years old. What do you buy a 10-year-old girl? I haven't a fucking clue. I know that I could ask her parents to buy her a gift, but I know they've already gotten her everything. Besides, she is a very sweet girl. She's not like Gus and Leo. She doesn't hold a grudge. That I know of. When I get to Neil's, the room is abuzz with adults. Machiko greets me. Merry Christmas, Louis. Would you like a glass of Spanish Rioja? Yes, I will have a glass of that delightful Rioja. Oh, this is excellent. Merry Christmas, I reply. Another glass of wine. Added to the glasses I had at Willie's, and it's apparent that the alcohol has begun to slowly take hold of me. Everything is taking on a slight glow. I hug my very close friend, Mark Lynn Baker, an exceptional actor. Like Neil, I met him at drama school. He's brought his daughter. Oh, shit. Another child I haven't bought a gift for. You are a stingy prick, Louis, he says. I didn't know she'd be here. Well, here she is. Well, what was I supposed to get her? A book would have been nice. A book? She's read Harry Potter. There are other books. Nancy Drew? You're an idiot, Louis. Yes, I am. I've known that for a long time. I never said I wasn't. Especially when it comes to females of all sizes, ages, and book preferences. Maybe I should have thought ahead and brought business cards that say, "Sorry, this is not my holiday." They'd ask me what was in those bags I brought, and I'd explain that I have gifts for their parents. Nothing for us! And then I'd have to admit that even though they're great kids, I like their parents more. And no, I don't have to worry about them reading this. I have no intention of buying this book for them either. I tell them I gave a gift in their name to kids who have nothing and are starving to death. I tell them this probably while my mouth was full of food. Say, that isn't a bad idea, though. Next year. Mark seems to be doing better than the last time I saw him. His wife is not with him. Their marriage, sadly, has been in the process of disintegrating. At times, I have witnessed this at these Christmas dinners. I can't imagine it. I certainly had my own hell to deal with, but this is way different. They have shared the birth and the life of their child together. It's reason enough for me not to get married and have children. As if I needed another reason. Unlike at Willie and Jenny's, the dinner here is more for friends than family. Each year, outside of Mark and me, there is a revolving guest list. All sorts of couples and singles have been in attendance over the years. They are designers, artists, restaurateurs, and business people. Every few years, another close friend of mine, Steve, the owner of the West Bank Cafe, and his wife Janet show up. They don't have children. Instead, they have a restaurant. I think children may be easier. A husband and wife running a business together must be a tough road, but they do it with grace, style, and killer senses of humor. They need to have all three. Otherwise, they'd have tried to kill each other, and I would have had to say something about them at their sentencings. The kids have their own table, which brings back memories. At holidays like Thanksgiving, my parents always had a table for adults and a table for kids. I always preferred sitting at the kids' table. I didn't need to listen to the adults prattle on about topics I had no interest in. The economy? Forget it. Politics? No thanks. Inflation? You gotta be kidding. It was a lot more fun playing with the muffins as if they were puppet heads than sitting at the big table, where you'd be reprimanded for playing with your food. Or blowing through the straw into your carbonated drink to make it bubble over the glass onto the tablecloth. Now that's entertainment. At the kids' table, you could be as goofy as you liked. It's a good thing for me that the kids have their own table, since at this point in my Christmas merrymaking, the wine is taking a toll on my verbal editing equipment. As you may have heard, I have a tendency to swear a teensy bit more than other people. The last thing that the tender young sensibilities need at Christmas dinner is to listen to me spout off about the load of bullshit that the douchebags are dumping on us because both political parties are so full of shit it's coming out their fucking eyes, or something equally thought-provoking and tasteful. I should just shut up and concentrate on eating. The meal is always wonderful. Prime rib. Can we please hear it for prime rib? I know the bovines and the vegans will be upset by this, but I can't help it. I love prime rib. I realize it's not as good for the cow as it is for me, but I'm sure she had a long and fun-filled life. I can tell by the way the meat cuts. Utter perfection. I know this is wrong. Everything one does is wrong when judged by someone who thinks it's wrong. And there's always someone who thinks whatever it is, no matter how innocuous, it's wrong. Even if most of the world thinks it's right. I mean, I get it. There are people who think eating meat is wrong. Taking the life of an animal is probably not the most moral thing to do. Even if you kill it in the nicest way imaginable, you are still killing it. If I am not screwing up one way, I am screwing up another. I was a vegetarian for a year, not out of some moral choice, but because I wanted new stuff to taste. Except tofu. Fuck tofu. It's the lamest reason to chew. And in the end, how do we know that vegetables aren't more intelligent and sensitive forms of life than those made of meat? We don't. Maybe they are an alien life form that is so advanced It's beyond our limited comprehension to recognize, and we are seriously fucking up by throwing together a salad. And we are just not listening. I am sure there's someone, somewhere,